Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Amir Barzin.
And Amir, I should introduce you again, is filling in as a co-host with me today, filling in for Adam as he is away. Thank you, Amir. Dr. Amir Barzin is one of our stellar resident physicians at UNC Family Medicine. Thanks for co-hosting with me today, Amir.
Thanks, Christy. I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, today, Amir, we get to talk with Dr. Aaron Troen, who is the principal investigator of the Nutrition and Brain Health Laboratory at the Institute of Biochemistry, Food Science, and Nutrition at Hebrew University of Jerusalem, about diet, our mind, and aging well. We are looking forward to that very important conversation and how it relates to dementia. But first, Amir, we've got some research that matters. What do we have today?
Absolutely. We're going to be talking about men who eat bacon and how that affects their sperm count.
About Oreos possibly being as addictive as cocaine.
About women in their course of drinking.
And about a link between flu shots and heart health and heart benefits. So let's get started with men and bacon and sperm. This sounds like a crazy study, but let's see what we have to learn.
Absolutely. This is something that I was very interested to read whenever I saw it, just based off of the principle. But what it was a study from the Harvard School of Public Health that looked at the consumption of processed foods, including those of bacon and sausage, and compared the sperm of those men to the sperm of men who ate things like cod and salmon.
And the bottom line is that men who eat a lot of processed meats, like bacon, have poor quality sperm than those who don't eat a lot of processed meats. And men whose diets include more fish, like white fish, like cod or halibut, had the highest level of the quality of their sperm, according to this study that is going to be presented at the American Society for Reproductive Medicine. So something about bacon and processed meats being linked to poor sperm. What do you think, Amir? What's the take-home message?
I think it means that all of our men who are looking to have children need to eat more fish and eat less bacon.
Yeah, I think if you're trying to start a family, this isn't conclusive, but certainly enough to me to say, you know, if you're trying to start a family, it might be worth laying off the bacon for a little while.
Absolutely, for more reasons than that, too.
That's a good point. Let's talk about Oreos, cocaine, and rats.
Another really interesting article. This was written out of the Center for Neurosciences at Connecticut College, and it was presented at the Neuroscience Conference in San Diego. And it was a study used to determine whether or not our minds like sugary, high-fat treats as Oreos as much as cocaine or heroin.
So, okay, what they did, I'll tell you the first part, everybody, and you'll say like, oh yeah, of course. So they took rats and they had Oreos in one room and a cracker in another room. And no surprise, the rats preferred to go to the room where there was an Oreo.
Absolutely. Yeah. Not a question about
right?
that.
Okay. They also took rats and they could go in one room and get cocaine or morphine, or they could go in the other room and get saline. And what? Shocker, no surprise, they would prefer to go to the room where they got drugs.
Not anything that we wouldn't have expected, probably.
Probably. Although, I'm sorry, I'm laughing. Those poor rats. Anyway, what they did, though, was they looked at their brains. And you can explain this, Amir.
Yeah. So the part that was most interesting about this is they actually looked at the brains of the rats on a cellular level. And they looked at the pleasure centers of the brain. And after eating Oreos, the rats had higher activity in their pleasure centers as compared to the same rats that were ingested with one of the jugs of cocaine or heroin.
And so that implies that that sort of pleasure seeking and that sort of excitement center of the brain was as strong from eating the sugary Oreos. I'm picturing my son on Oreos, sort of what happens, as sort of that same pleasure center, which is, you know, linked with addiction and cocaine.
Absolutely. One of the things that's really interesting about it going forward with the great growth in the rate of childhood obesity that we have in America nowadays. And so it'll be interesting to see what comes of this kind of research that's being done.
Yeah, and it's not to pick on Oreos specifically. They use that really just as a proxy for a sugary treat. And it's like America's most popular cookie, I guess.
I think that's true for everyone.
I know. So be careful. You could be getting addicted to Oreos. Okay. We're joking. This is actually important research that hopefully will help us understand over time how people become addicted to certain things and potentially how we can help. Speaking of addiction, let's talk about the rise of women alcoholics.
In a most recent book, an author that wrote the book Drink, Ann Dossett Johnson, chronicled her path through addiction and really about women's addiction patterns in the U.S. with alcohol consumption over the past years.
And she really pointed out that we've normalized drinking in some ways by saying, oh, a glass of red wine a day, you know, may have some heart benefits. And by doing that, it's potentially been a factor of a really rise in drinking among women. So an analysis that was done in her book showed of national surveys that 47% of white women were regular drinkers in 2002, which is up from 37% a decade earlier. There was also a rise among African-American women and Hispanic women compared with a decade earlier.
And another thing that I thought was very interesting about this whole research that was conducted was that binge drinking, something that I think many of us just associate with a college-age group, is actually seen in 10% of women between the ages of 45 to 64 and 3% of women over the age of 65.
And she talks in her book about some of the risks of sort of highly educated women with stressful jobs and sort of how there can be a creep over the years. And Amir, I was just talking to a very highly educated, successful career woman at the gym who was talking a little bit about her drinking. And as we were talking, you know, I realized she's talking about drinking 3 or 4 glasses of wine a night. You know, one as she's cooking, another as she's sitting down for dinner, and another one afterwards after she gets the kids down. And when you add that up over a week, that is very, very risky drinking. It, for whatever reason, women process alcohol slightly differently than men. So really, you know, 7 or 8 drinks of wine a week is really the maximum that we should have, or you get really into that risky drinking category. So women out there, be careful with how much you're drinking.
Absolutely.
Lay off a couple days. The last study is about flu shots and heart benefits. And this was an interesting review of 5 different randomized trials that involved more than 6,400 heart patients.
And in all, what they found from the take-home from this research that was conducted is that by just doing something as simply as getting a flu shot, you decrease your relative risk for heart disease by 36%, and actually 55% if you had a prior heart disease or had a diagnosis of heart disease.
So this was research that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And the bottom line is, you know, everybody out there, you should get your flu shot. Wash your hands, get your flu shot. But if you are a heart patient, you know, it really may have an additional benefit and be especially important for you. So everybody go out there and get that flu shot and get protected. We've had a chance, Amir, to talk a little bit about flu shots and about women drinking.
About Oreos and the addiction. And then also about bacon and sperm counts.
Yeah, interesting research today. That will conclude the Research That Matters portion of the show. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Troen about diet, our mind, and aging well. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Amir Barzan and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Amir Barzin and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we're privileged to have Dr. Aaron Troen, the principal investigator of the Nutrition and Brain Health Laboratory at the Institute of Biochemistry, Food Science, and Nutrition at Hebrew University of Jerusalem. And we're going to be talking today about diet, our mind, and aging well.
Welcome, Dr. Troen. We're so pleased to have you with us all the way from Israel.
Well, I'm delighted to be here with you, too.
Well, we really want to dive right in and find out first about you. We know that you have, you know, certainly have a very reputable background as an expert in this topic, but how did you become so interested in nutrition and aging and aging well?
Well, I actually started out in neuroscience for my undergraduate degree and was fascinated with memory and Alzheimer's disease in the sense that memory makes us who we are, and losing our memory raises the question of where we are, where our self really resides. And with that question in mind, I went to Oxford University for PhD studies with David Smith in the Oxford Project to Investigate Memory and Aging, or OPTIMA Project. And originally, I thought I'd be exploring the association between changes on brain scan and neuropsychological testing in demented patients and controls.
So hold on, break that down. You thought you would be studying, like, changes on scans of the brain with people's memory?
Yes, I thought that I'd be looking at changes in brain scan in this very interesting population that they've been studying for several years. And the results that these patients and controls, non-demented individuals, had on psychological testing. The idea would be to devise better and earlier diagnostic tests for Alzheimer's disease. But shortly before I arrived, they had made a seminal observation that low levels of folate and high levels of homocysteine in blood were about three times as likely to be found in Alzheimer patients than in controls. In other words, that these might be risk factors for the disease. And as a very young and naive undergrad, I was asked, or new doctoral student, I was asked to follow up this observation. And I became fascinated by the idea that there might be some risk factors, environmental risk factors, including those associated with nutrition, over which we might be able to exert some control and thereby modify the risk of disease that's associated with it.
And so,
the PhD project itself turned out to be rather frustrating, but I was stuck with this itch to try to understand it, and I've been with that question really ever since.
And I'm sure it became more fascinating and more promising as you started to discover more information about it. So you mentioned low folate and high homocysteine levels. Help us understand what that means in terms of a relationship to nutrition and food.
Sure. Folate is a vitamin. It's found largely in vegetables and was originally isolated from spinach, which is where the word folate comes from. And it's a compound which is used by the body in various biochemical reactions. And these are fundamentally important biochemical reactions. Some of them have to do with the synthesis of the building blocks for DNA. Some of them have to do with methylation reactions. These are reactions in which a single carbon unit is put onto various accepting molecules. Could be DNA to switch genes on and off. It could be other compounds, such as those that are used in neurotransmitters or hormones for controlling the communication between nerve cells, or between the regulation, endocrine regulation of different physiological processes in the body. Some methylation reactions are necessary for building blocks of other kinds of proteins in the body, such as structural modifications to myelin, the kind of insulation on the nervous system's wiring, which allows the communication to proceed quickly and effectively without short-circuiting. And so deficiencies of folate could impact all of these types of processes in a bad way. Another thing that folate does biochemically is to help clear homocysteine as part of this metabolic process. And when homocysteine builds up in blood, it is thought by some people to be toxic. There are ways in which you could theoretically, and to some extent experimentally, show the high levels of homocysteine, which is an amino acid that is an intermediate in metabolism, and normally is kept at quite low levels. When it accumulates, it can chemically attack various proteins or molecules that are structural components of cells, functional components of cells, leading to damage. So low folate can essentially impair processes that are important for brain function, as well as many other physiological processes in the body.
So talking about both this folate and homocysteine levels and how they impact our brain function, given the fact that dementia, and particularly Alzheimer's, is growing at such a rapid rate, what did you find next about nutrition and brain health, and what do you think is the next step in evaluating for prevention of things like Alzheimer's and dementia?
Well, those are very
big
large questions.
Yeah, we'll let you do it one at a time.
I think I'd break that down. First of all, in terms of what I've learned beyond folate, I think it's interesting to think about these nutritional associations where we see the connection between a given nutritional factor. It could be folate, it could be vitamin B12, vitamin B6, vitamin E, vitamin C, fish oils, etc. And the health outcomes that we look at in population studies, they can all give us an insight into particular mechanisms. If we understand the basic biochemistry, we know what folate is used for in the body, then that may give us hints as to processes that, if they are affected, might be important for the development of disease. Mm-hmm. Now, one such example could be cholesterol. Cholesterol and its relationship to heart disease was originally identified through population studies. For example, an important study that compared Japanese who were living in Japan and Japanese who were living in Hawaii and their risk of heart disease. And those who lived in Hawaii had higher risk of heart disease, even though they all had the same genetic background. The distinguishing factor was their diet and the risk of high cholesterol. And subsequently, cholesterol became a target for investigation. Now, we know a great deal now, many years later, about what cholesterol does biologically, certainly by no means everything about it. But several Nobel Prizes later, and the development of blockbuster drugs, such as the statin, which lower cholesterol, we now have molecular tools that rationally target a pathway that's involved in cardiovascular disease.
So
in a similar way, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to go ahead. I think you're about to say what I was going to hypothesize. Go ahead.
So in a similar way, if we understand these epidemiological associations from a mechanistic perspective, we can then use that perspective in two ways. One, in order to intervene with nutrition and try to reduce the associated risk. But sometimes the intervention of nutrition is not going to be powerful enough. We can also use that to understand molecular mechanisms and try to develop better drug-based therapies and treatments for prevention or treatment of the disease.
Absolutely, and I'm going to take just a short break here, and when we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Troen, about diet, our mind, and aging well. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Amir Barzin and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Amir Barzin and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Aaron Troen, the principal investigator of the Nutrition and Brain Health Laboratory at the Institute of Biochemistry, Food Science, and Nutrition at Hebrew University of Jerusalem, about diet, our mind, and aging well. And before the break, Dr. Troen, you were helping us understand some relationships between certain vitamins and elements in nutrition, like folate and homocysteine and potentially vitamin B12 and fish oil and all these different elements of nutrition that people have drawn some associations with health outcomes. And in particular, you are studying these relationships on dementia. And we understand that you are in the understanding phase, where you're really trying to understand how all of this works in the body, how these vitamins, what kind of relationship they have with the cells and the building blocks of nerves, and how that affects memory. But as we think about, as our listeners are listening to us, other than being super impressed with what you're doing that will change the future, what kinds of things are hypothesized out there that maybe we should pay attention to in our diet as it relates to memory?
Well, my particular focus on the B vitamins, on folate and B12 and homocysteine, has really led me to consider the roles of cardiovascular health in brain aging. The same risk factors that dietarily tend to cause cardiovascular disease or be associated with cardiovascular disease are the same risk factors that show up when you look at the relation between nutrition and brain health or brain aging. So on the whole, it's the heart-healthy diet or dietary patterns that are generally associated with better cognitive outcomes.
Hmm.
And as a whole, I think what you're trying to say is that it's a whole-body experience. Nutrition is just one element that feeds into this hypothesis of decreasing our decline in cognitive disease, and taking care of our bodies is something that we need to do on a multi-level. Is that correct?
That's almost certainly true. In terms of what we know about these associations from studying population. It's difficult to move from a population study to making individual recommendations, even though that's the normal direction that you take in public health when you try to look at evidence-based medicine and make recommendations for clinical practice.
And so this relationship between the heart health risk factors, being smoking and cholesterol and elements of the diet that can be related to obesity and diabetes and those sorts of things, eating the same things that would be in a heart-healthy diet would potentially be in a brain-healthy diet? Is that what you're saying?
That is what I'm saying. In terms of clinical trials are difficult to design when we look at nutrition for a variety of reasons. In a sense, the evidence we have for designing the trials comes from population studies, which really are focused, if we were to translate them into a design or an experiment where we would want to intervene, say by increasing folate to lower homocysteine and lower the associated risk of disease. Ideally, we would want to do that in populations that are disease-free and follow them up for decades, which is what the observational epidemiological studies look at. Unfortunately, that's not so practical. So what people have done is to take individuals who are at high risk, say they already have pre-existing heart conditions, and in those, they've intervened with vitamins to try to see if they can prevent recurrent heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
Those types of trials have tended to fail and have undermined the efforts to understand this relationship and to do what we really need to do is figure out, can we obtain the evidence for prevention, primary prevention, not necessarily secondary prevention of existing disease or the deterioration due to existing disease. Now, in terms of cognitive health, I'll give you an example. There have been maybe 14 studies looking at B vitamin supplementation and cognitive outcomes. Based on the epidemiological literature, which overwhelmingly suggests there's an association between low vitamins and or high homocysteine and poor cognitive outcomes. And most of those trials have failed. Some of them have been focused on primary cardiovascular prevention with a secondary cognitive outcome, and some of them have looked specifically at cognitive outcomes. But two of them have actually been successful. So here there's a mix, and you ask the question, on balance, do we go with the ones that didn't work or do we go with the ones that did work? And it's interesting to try to figure out what made some of the trials or what are the features of those trials that showed benefit that makes them different from the trials that don't have benefit. And there are several things that are worth noting. One is that they were done in populations in Europe that aren't exposed to high levels of folic acid that populations such as American populations are exposed to simply through food folate fortification. That means that they're starting out on average with poor vitamin levels.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Secondly, they looked at outcomes in populations that were at risk but were generally healthy, and they use sensitive measures, either near psychological testing or measures of brain atrophy. And if you look at those studies carefully, they're really suggesting that the people who have high homocysteine and who are most responsive to the B vitamin, probably because they have relatively low levels of intake initially, those are the people who tend to benefit most in these trials. So there's some very good hints here that treatment might be effective in those people who have a deficiency of the vitamin.
Okay.
So problem is, yeah, go ahead.
No, so potentially that could mean that people could be tested, and if they had certain levels of those vitamins, that then you could do something about it and prevent dementia.
And prevent dementia. I think in the long run, that's
the dream.
Certainly a possibility. To do that or prove that definitively, we'd actually have to do very long-term studies in appropriate populations that didn't have high levels of B vitamins to begin with. We'd have to screen them and test them. But you run into all sorts of interesting ethical questions. If I were to turn to you and say, would you like to be in a trial where I'm going to give you a vitamin that I don't think will hurt you, but I think may benefit you, and I'm going to flip a coin and randomize you either to receive treatment or receive a placebo. Would you be willing to participate in a trial like that?
Well, people do it all the time, participate in those trials.
They participate in clinical trials, but they participate in clinical trials where, say, in chemotherapy, they have cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And the outcomes are bad. Now, they're going to be treated with a treatment that may make it worse, may make it better, or may be indifferent. But we need to know if these treatments are safe and effective. In the case of vitamins, you're saying, gee, this isn't going to hurt you, and it may help you, and I want you to take a placebo, which, if I'm right in my hypothesis, means you're going to perform worse. You're going to be at mm-hmm. more risk than the people who are getting the treatment.
Well, and who's going to fund that? It's not like there's a big vitamin company out there who necessarily is going to want to pay for a study that would take that many people over that long of a time.
That's another consideration. The economic incentives here are not nearly as strong as they are in the private sector, in the pharma world. Of course, from the public health perspective, this could be enormous. But there isn't going to be a return on the investment because these trials are very expensive. And if you really are looking at primary prevention rather than at treatment, you've got to follow a large number of people for a very long time. Now, in addition to that, if you're looking at nutrients instead of drugs, this is not only something that the placebo group can go to their CVS and take anyway, which means you're going to have a problem of not only of compliance, but of people who are in the placebo group who are taking the drug. And there are examples of this in the literature, by the way.
So
and
it's a tough thing to study.
We're also normally exposed to these compounds. So people have a normal background level of vitamins. It's not the same thing as a cancer drug where either you get it in the treatment or you don't have it at all. So it makes these trials very, very difficult to perform. And that means that it's going to be hard to come up with the definitive evidence to be able to tell people what they want to know, which is how much should I take and what's the benefit to me individually. Amir, you said before that, yes, we should screen people, measure their vitamin levels if they're low, supplement, and that might be a good approach. But again, it's going to be hard to tell the clinicians, the doctors, here's what you should do because here's what it means in terms of hard numbers. How is this going to benefit the individual?
Okay. Well, Dr. Trohan, thank you for the hard work that you are doing in your research to really make headway and make a difference in something that's been very hard to tackle in prevention and potentially treatment for Alzheimer's disease in the future. And thank you for taking time to share that with our listeners.
Pleasure.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Amir Barzin and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Amir and I will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
If you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu.
We've got some great questions today about some common and some rare things. We're going to talk about mold. We're going to talk about heart problems related to pregnancy.
We're going to talk about Plan B or the emergency contraceptive pill, and then also something you may not have heard of called Proteus syndrome.
So we'd like to ask our executive producer, Erica Lloyd, to read us our very first House Call question of the day. Erica?
We just moved to Chapel Hill from Florida. When we moved into our new home, we discovered there was mold in the showers and in several other places with tile. We, of course, are shocked and worried about getting sick. Should we contact the health department?
You know, there are so many people concerned about mold. And I mean, I don't know about you, Amir, but I feel like I have patients pretty frequently coming in concerned that there's something in their apartment or some mold in an old house that's affecting their health. And so I think your question is a really common one.
Absolutely. I actually had two patients this last week bring up this exact point. And I think one of the things that's important to remember is that mold is usually most of the common things that it'll cause will be allergic reactions. And going along guidelines that have been given to us by the EPA, which is the Environmental Protection Agency, and the Center for Disease Control, they actually don't recommend testing for mold or routine sampling whenever mold is present.
And there's really not any defined exposure for humans that's safe or not safe. And it's also very difficult to prove that the mold is having any untoward effect on your health. The most common thing that people will have related to mold and health is problems with allergy. So you may have, you know, symptoms of seasonal allergy, runny nose. It could affect your asthma, watery eyes, sneezing, sinusy type symptoms related to that. But at this point, there's not like a measured level. A lot of times people will try to get a note from the doctor just saying, hey, my allergies are worse. Can you move me to a different apartment? Something along those lines. But getting it formally tested is not really super helpful.
Absolutely. So thank you for that question and something that a lot of people want addressed.
Let's have our next House Call question, Erica.
My sister recently had twins that were healthy, but during her pregnancy, she was diagnosed with heart failure that persisted once the babies were born. She is doing pretty well, but it was really scary. I'm thinking of getting pregnant myself now, but I'm worried this will happen to me. What advice do you have?
Well, congratulations to your sister for having the healthy twins. And we certainly, feel our heart goes out to her for having to be challenged with something like heart failure during pregnancy. I'm sure that was very scary. There's a fancy word for that, heart failure, that can happen to people pregnant or not, but it's called cardiomyopathy. And we'll get our fantastic health sciences librarians to put up a link about cardiomyopathy and its definition to understand what we're talking about. But it's a disease that can weaken or enlarge your heart muscle and make it not work as well. So a very scary thing, and I'm sorry that happened to your sister.
And in general, cardiomyopathy can happen because of multiple medical conditions, but what we normally intend to see if cardiomyopathy is present because of a pregnancy is that over the course of time and after delivery, most of these cases actually end up resolving and they get better and you don't have to stay on medications in the long run.
And I think it's something like 21% of people who have that in a pregnancy may have a recurrence with a future pregnancy. So definitely something to monitor, something that can be very serious. So it would be important for your sister to, you know, plan carefully for a future pregnancy and to do that in conjunction with an obstetrician specialist in this area.
Absolutely. And for yourself, in regards to your wanting to get pregnant, is that, you know, just making sure that you're getting the prenatal care you need to be monitored by a good physician who will be looking out for those signs.
So thank you for your question. And let's take our next house call question, Erica.
I'm a freshman in college and recently had unprotected sex. I took the Plan B pill the very next day, which was about 3 weeks ago, but I've yet to get my period. What does the pill do within my body to prevent pregnancy, and can I expect a normal period this month?
I think that this is a great question. And for those of you who don't know, Plan B is actually the first emergency contraception that was FDA approved to be available in the aisle. So you do no longer need a doctor's prescription to be able to get this medication. And the way that it works is basically it prevents ovulation. It's a backup plan that uses medications that would be found in normal birth control to limit the ovulation of a female.
And to answer your question about can you expect a normal period this month, you may have some changes in your menstrual cycle related to taking that medication. I would certainly test yourself for pregnancy, and because certainly this is not effective if you already are pregnant, and just say that, you know, really recommit to making good choices about your body, using condoms, abstinence, or picking one partner and sticking with them for a lifetime is really the best way to prevent an unplanned pregnancy or to prevent yourself from getting a sexually transmitted infection. So be careful. Thank you for your questions. Let's take our very last house call question.
My neighbor's child was recently diagnosed with Proteus syndrome. He is 3 years old and is the sweetest little thing. I don't want to seem nosy and ask what it is, how do you get it, and how does it impact a person's life. I want to be respectful but knowledgeable. We are a close-knit neighborhood who wants to help the family in any way we can, but in order to do so, I think familiarizing ourselves is the first step. What can you tell me about Proteus syndrome?
Wow, this is a great question, and definitely one of the ones that I had to look into more because it is such a rare syndrome. But to give everyone a good general background of what Proteus syndrome is, it's a condition that causes overgrowth of the bones, skin, and other tissues, which can lead to development of larger limbs. It can also lead to excess tumor growth, and sometimes shows up as people having bones that are out of proportion compared to the rest of their body.
So like a person could have distinctive facial features. So this little sweet boy, as he grows, could have a longer face or distinctive features of his nose or things that are asymmetric. Some people have problems with brain development, so there could be some disability in his brain development over time and potentially seizures. But it's pretty rare, and it's unclear how all of that relates to the abnormal growth and unclear what exactly will happen in this child's life. So our advice to you is really to do as you're doing and care about them and be in community with them and reach out to them for ways that you can just kind of walk alongside them through this in life.
Yeah, providing support to them in any way that they may need it, I think, will be just as beneficial as any medical treatment or diagnosis in the years to come.
Thank you for great questions today. We've talked a little bit about Proteus syndrome, about Plan B.
We've also discussed the thoughts of postpartum cardiomyopathy, and then also about the concern for mold in the home.
Thanks for your questions. We hope we've answered those questions. And for all of you joining us for your health today, we hope that we've covered some issues and concerns that are important to you and to your health. We want you to share your questions, write us your stories, reactions, by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, our health app by going to the App Store and searching Your Health, one word, for a free download.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Aaron Trowan. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
And I want to thank you, Dr. Amir Barzin, for filling in for Adam Goldstein while he is away and being an excellent co-host. Thank you, Amir.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Amir Barzin.
We'll look forward to talking with you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.